I guess it won't surprise many of you if I say it's been an intense few weeks on a number of levels for me recently. 2 round-trip transatlantic flights in less than a month has my body still trying to figure out what time it really is. And I know most of you are familiar with the mental and emotional roller coaster that accompanies bereavement. The outpouring of love and sympathy, support and concern, and understanding from all of you has been tremendous, and I thank you for it. It was similar in Wisconsin as well. My entire family was overwhelmed by the enormous number of people who demonstrated sympathy and support, especially for my mom, and also expressed a deep appreciation and admiration for my dad. The death of a loved one is never easy, but it's particularly in moments of crisis and loss that the gifts of a faith community manifest in abundance. It hasn't only been my family that's been grieving in the past few weeks, though. A number of you have also been dealing with difficult news, troubling family situations, concerns about a friend, or complications relating to work or health or your children or your partner. That's before we even pick up the newspaper. Beyond the walls of our own homes, across the world, the past 2 weeks have been incredibly intense. Multiple killer tornadoes, a week and a half ago and then a couple of days ago in Oklahoma, with a rising death toll and many bereaved families. A horrifying, brutal attack and murder in broad daylight, committed in the name of religion, not even 90 minutes from here. Ongoing atrocities in Syria and brutal warfare in Nigeria, relentless famine and growing desperation in Somalia, and the worst violence and terror attacks that Iraq has seen for several years has unfolded across the past several days. There are moments when I wonder, how much can we really take? How much can we take in? Can we possibly absorb or apprehend the scope of everything we see on a single night's headline news? If we don't just go numb or begin to tune it out, it might be easy on a Sunday morning to wonder how what we're doing here this morning can possibly mean anything or change anything, given the breadth and depth of the issues facing our personal lives, to say nothing of the world around us. In fact, given some of the dynamics portrayed in our first lesson from 1 Kings, it's possible to understand why some who haven't probed very deeply might reject the Bible as having anything useful or helpful to say to us today. In a time when it's imperative that people of different faiths respect each other rather than denigrate each other, how should we handle this story? What are we meant to do with this text in which the themes, our prophet is better than your prophet, our faith is better than your faith, and our God is better than your God, seem to be the points of the story? Clearly, this text, and others like it in our scriptures, must be approached with real humility and caution. As James Hopkins wisely observes, our violence-plagued world certainly does not need more people doing harm to each other because they feel that their God is superior or because they feel their God has been offended. In handling this story, it is best to let it raise questions in our minds rather than attitudes of superiority in our hearts. Another biblical scholar, Carolyn Sharp, aptly points out, however we read this story, it underscores the life and death stakes involved in cultural disputes over how to understand the holy. She goes on to interpret some of its meaning specifically for the church. Here we find both encouragement and admonition directed to those within the believing congregation, she writes. The encouragement: believers are not to despair when they experience God as hidden or absent. They are to trust that God will answer prayer. Beneath the encouragement is an unmistakable warning to those faithful who might have been tempted to practice syncretistic religion, that is, to hedge their bets by worshiping the divine in multiple cultural manifestations. The warning: apostasy results in death. I suspect that most of us here wouldn't guess that syncretism or apostasy, that is, the blending of different religious traditions or different ways of worshiping, or worshiping different gods even, is a big problem for us. Certainly, we're not worshiping Baal and Yahweh. Or are we? Only Baal is just known by a different name. Even today, we're tempted to give our loyalty, commitment, and worship to idols alongside God. We may not acknowledge our behavior as worship, but when things such as financial security, self-gratification, or even family take priority in our lives over obedience and service to God, they indeed become idols, and we worship them. Quoting Carolyn Sharp again, our tendency to cling to sources of security that are not God leaves us looking by turns ridiculous and pathetic. The biting irony of the Elijah story requires candor about this. We frantically dance to appease powers that are not real. We try to ensure prosperity through things that cannot respond to us. We look for hope in things that cannot truly transform our lives. When we fail to recognize God as the source of our rest and our peace, we live our lives chaotically, on the edge of desperation. The common thread between our lectionary texts this morning is the ultimate and transforming power of faith in the one true God. And it's that thread that connects the passages up with our daily life and all of its challenges. But what is faith? Marcus Borg — Laurence isn't here this morning, so maybe not a cheer from the congregation — but Marcus Borg wrote a wonderful book entitled The Heart of Christianity, Rediscovering a Life of Faith. In it, he suggests that there are four historical meanings of faith in the Christian tradition, but the best is fundamentally a matter of relationship, a matter of the heart. Drawing on the Latin word fiducia, he writes, there is no close English word for faith as fiducia. The closest is fiduciary, which doesn't get us very far. So I move to the best English translation. Fiducia is faith as trust, as radical trust in God. Significantly, it does not mean trusting in the truth of a set of statements about God. That would simply be a census, which is another of the religious words he used. That would be a census under a different name. Rather, it means trusting in God. Faith as trust is like floating in a deep ocean. I owe the metaphor to Søren Kierkegaard, a radical Christian and one of the philosophical giants of the 19th century. Faith is like floating in 70,000 fathoms of water. If you struggle, if you tense up and thrash about, you will eventually sink. But if you relax and trust, you'll float. It's just like Matthew's story of Peter walking on the water with Jesus. When he began to be afraid, he began to sink. To help an adult class see this meaning of faith, my wife asked them, how many of you have taught a small child to swim? Many had. When asked to describe the experience, all said that the biggest hurdle was getting the child to relax in the water. Their consistent refrain was, it's okay, just relax. You'll float, it's okay. Faith as trust is trusting in the buoyancy of God. Faith is trusting in the sea of being in which we live and move and have our being. He continues helpfully. We can also see this meaning of faith by turning to its opposite. The opposite of trust is not doubt or disbelief, but mistrust. More interestingly and provocatively, its opposite is anxiety or worry. We see this meaning in familiar words attributed to Jesus. He invites his hearers to see reality as marked by a cosmic generosity. "Consider the birds of the air," Jesus said. "They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet God feeds them. Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin, yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not clothed like one of these." 4 times in the extended passage in which these familiar lines appear, Jesus says to his hearers, "Do not worry." In other words, "Don't be anxious." And then adds, "You of little faith." Little faith and anxiety go together. If you're anxious, you have little faith. Thus, we can measure our degree of faith as trust by the amount of anxiety in our lives. I mention this not to provide yet one more failing for which to chastise ourselves, but because of the good news implicit in this realization. Growth in faith as trust casts out anxiety. Who of us would not want a life with less anxiety, to say nothing of an anxiety-free life? If we were not anxious, can you imagine how free we would be, how immediately present we would be able to be, how well we would be able to love? Faith as radical trust has great transforming power. It was this faith as radical trust that amazed Jesus about the centurion. The version that Catherine read used the word astonished. Jesus was only amazed or astonished twice in the gospel accounts. Once by the lack of faith from the people of his hometown, and again on the occasion we heard about this morning, when a centurion from Capernaum appealed to Jesus to heal his slave, or in Catherine's version, in the New English, the Revised English Bible version, his servant. And now, so before I go any further into the story, I want to acknowledge the difficult and offensive notion that 2 of the central characters in the story are a slave or servant and his master, and the fact that Jesus doesn't seem to concern himself with the fundamental problem of that relationship. It's troubling to say the least, and definitely worth some scrutiny. I wonder if the reason Jesus seemed untroubled as he made his way to the centurion's house, or the reason he didn't comment on the power dynamics in any way to his disciples or those who were with him, was because Jesus recognized that the centurion was not, in fact, living out the troubling slave-owner relationship as we would understand it or expect it. The centurion seemed to be demonstrating a capacity for behavior that we might well call radical welcome. Jesus was being asked by one of the most powerful to heal the least powerful one of all. The slave lived on the margin, without voice or vote in what became of him. He served, dependent upon the generosity of his boss to provide for him, in sickness as well as health. The centurion could have treated him as disposable, replacing him with someone more able-bodied. But he didn't. A high-ranking Roman official, having command over 100 men, which is what gave him his title, centurion, he had managed to become a respected and admired member of the Jewish community. He, a Roman, the face of the occupying forces to that Jewish community. He was likely a God-fearer, a Gentile who was drawn to Judaism because of its monotheism and ethical teachings. He was obviously familiar with the Jewish teachings and customs, which he demonstrated by his sensitivity to having Jesus approach his house, he knew that it would be unacceptable for the teacher, the rabbi, to enter the house or even to shake the hand of one who was considered unclean, which is why he had sent friends ahead to Jesus with his messages. Although he hadn't taken the dramatic step toward conversion by being circumcised, the centurion had nonetheless become a connected and trustworthy member of the Jewish community, of that faith community. The evidence is when the Jewish leaders testify to the soldier's worthiness by lifting up how he has been accountable to the larger community. He has loved our people, they say. Further, he has built our synagogue. Both of these are expressions of affection and care offered by a military officer who's under no obligation, but does so out of some deep connectedness to the people, love and accountability to the community. But it wasn't the fact that the guy paid for the synagogue, nor the fact that he knew the Jewish law, that astonished and amazed Jesus. It was that he demonstrated absolute confidence in Jesus' ability to heal his servant. Furthermore, this man of power and authority was speaking on behalf of the one who had no voice in society. And that's what makes this lesson relevant to our lives and the world today as well. Faith is about living in community and about confidence in the power and the ability and the desire of God to work in us and through us for the healing and wholeness of others. Jan Holton sums it up beautifully. She writes, "When our faith is enacted on behalf of another, it celebrates our web of human connectedness, especially in times of illness and tragedy. This is the imperative of faith living in the world. In this time, when storms rage, wars and political corruption wreak havoc, children are senselessly dying, and droughts of all sorts parch our cultural landscape, our world is thirsty indeed for a God whose word can once again water the earth and bring forth fruitfulness in believers for the sake of the world. In these days when the world and its events seem particularly intense, when our lives and those of our neighbors, whether next door or global, are beset by tragedy, chaos, loss, and frustration, we as people of faith and hope in the living God have a call to answer. Let us pray for faith as bold as the centurion's and confidence in God's ability and preparation to act that is as robust and audacious as Elijah's." Amen.